Hello and welcome to the Popmatic Podcast. This is where we'll tell you about the best books, movies, and music to download. You know, if you lost your book, maybe you want to download another copy. Available for checkout at the Nashville Public Library. And we'll also tell you about other things like
book signings, author talks, classes and workshops, sand art performances, and movies.
Such as?
Well, such as on July 9th, if you come to the Downtown Public Library, you can see Man in the Wilderness, directed by Richard Sarafian and starring Richard Harris in one of his better roles but least known. It also stars John Huston. Once again, come July 9th to the Downtown Public Library and at 2 o'clock. Also, check out the podcast page for interview with the director Richard Sarafian, who directed Man in the Wilderness. He also directed Vanishing Point and that cool episode of The Twilight Zone that featured Talking Tina.
But on the show today, Firecracker, it's July. So we discuss our favorite American musicians, America Punk. Maybe we need a new MC. And we'll also start talking about what's tickling our fancy this month. We all know America by heart, but that's okay because we were born this way. So we're going to talk about our favorite musicians. And joining us today is
Jesse from the Reference Department.
Bill Chamberlain from Popular Materials.
Crystal from Popular Materials.
Amanda is always holding down the fort for the pop mat.
And Lisa from YA.
And I'm Brian. I get paid to lift weights while I listen to Leslie Gore records for the library. I think I work in Popular Materials too. But Jesse's going to go first when he tells us about
Otis Redding is who I'm going to talk about. I'm going to preface with, it took me a long time to like whittle through my list of people that I wanted to talk about. I was really thinking about talking about Kanye West because he really embodies like the American spirit to me in the way that the city of Las Vegas does, is like capitalism taken to its extreme potential, shiny lights and robot voices. And I also wanted to use my joke about how I think 808s and Heartbreaks is concept album about a heartbroken robot, but I couldn't really honestly say that Kanye West is my favorite, but so I decided instead to talk about Otis Redding, who maybe doesn't even need me to recommend him to you because he's so amazing and awesome, and everyone probably should know this. You know, I went to Israel a few years ago and was in Jerusalem, where people have psychotic episodes where they are overwhelmed with the spirit of religion in the city, and I felt absolutely nothing standing in these 3,000-year-old buildings and like standing at the Wailing Wall, but going to the Stax Record Museum and standing in the spot where he recorded all of his music, like, I felt the spirit of Otis Redding there more than I felt anything in a church or anything like that ever. And he's just amazing. His voice is awesome. He died way too young, and that's really sad to think about what he could have done, but just what he did leave is supersedes anybody who's ever had any other giant long career. Things to check out, pretty much any of the like hits compilations that we have here at the library are good. There's a DVD of the Monterey Pop Festival that has some of his songs on it, and they're amazing. I really don't like live albums at all. I can't stand, I think they're boring and silly, and I don't like applause and guitar solos and stuff like that.
That makes pretty bad, too.
Yeah, so. But Otis Redding's live recordings are amazing. We've got a Live in London and Paris by him that it's just, like, the energy that he takes, it's, like, super punk rock. It's like the MC5 in their day or something like that that he's doing when he's playing live. And he does some really awesome versions of, like, Satisfaction by the Stones and Day Tripper by the Monkees. He makes that have all the credibility in the world that the Monkees could never have attained on their own, I think. He's just an amazing guy. So check out Otis Redding. If you have been living under a rock and don't know who he is, you'll be pleasantly surprised.
Do you think it's better to burn out than to fade away?
That's, you know, I don't, it depends on who you are. Like, maybe Lou Reed should have burned out a long time ago. But I don't want to wish anyone dead or anything like that. Maybe just an early retirement. I actually thought about talking about Lou Reed also, because I love Lou Reed, but...
And he's American.
And now on to Bill, who's going to talk about Leonard Cohen. No,
just kidding. I remember it well. The year was 1977, and I had my stereo on, and the song they played was called Short People by Randy Newman. The lyrics went like this. They got little hands, little eyes. They walk around telling great big lies. They got little noses and tiny little teeth. They wear platform shoes on their nasty little feet. The song became a surprise hit of that year and a controversial song at the time. People threw eggs at pictures of Randy Newman. At the time, I became a huge fan of Randy Newman. In doing research, I found Newman writes from a perspective of a character, but not Randy Newman's perspective. For example, Short People was written from a perspective of an insane man who hates short people. In the song Political Science, a U.S. nationalist wants to drop the big one on them all for the ingratitudes towards America. And just to mention, Randy Newman has written many film scores that include Cold Turkey, The Natural, and Ragtime. But the song I want to leave you with today is Louisiana 1927, which tells of the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927. But the song was written in 1974 and has become more relevant since Hurricane Katrina. And now here's a clip from Louisiana 1927.
Louisiana, Louisiana, that time to wash us away, that time to wash us away, Louisiana, Louisiana, that time to wash us away, that time to wash us away.
Have you heard that Harry Nilsson sings the songs of Randy Newman record?
Yes.
We've got that in Friegel for anybody who wants to listen to it. And Newman actually plays piano while Nilsson sings, and it's really awesome.
And did you know Glenn Frey sang backup on the Short People?
Did he? He's got lots of friends. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
I was just watching Weeds last night, and I'm on the season where they go on the lam, and that one of the characters names himself Randy Newman.
That's totally my pseudonym if I get
one. Like, for the Newmans, I'll be Randy Newman, of course.
Like, his uncles were Alfred Newman and Lionel Newman, who wrote practically every 20th Century Fox score.
I did not know that.
Magazine as well.
No.
Not Alfred Newman. Did he sing the theme song to Monk?
No, really.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
I thought I saw that.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
I think he's won more Oscars than almost anybody alive, also for the music that he's written.
Well, it's kind of funny. He's only won two, and he was nominated for
it.
Almost every year. And then I remember it was.
I get sick of nominating.
2001, he won. And I mean, the audience went nuts.
Yeah.
And I think it was for Monsters, Inc., I think it was.
Real time fact check.
And he won last year, too.
Awesome.
If any of your facts are wrong, you'll be booted too. Much as the same.
I don't do math, so you're good.
Yeah.
Bill's like, no, they're right.
I'm just blinded by my love for Randy Newman. I assume that he's won all of those awards.
Just thinking about it gives you religious experience.
A couple of years? Yeah. Are you making fun of me now?
No.
Honest openness.
I love it.
This is no place.
I love it.
I appreciate the emotion that music can.
Do I hand it off to Crystal?
Yeah.
Okay,
I think
Crystal,
you should do this
what are you recommending?
Right. When I think about my favorite American musicians, a couple female artists come to mind. So if you'll indulge me, I'd like to briefly mention them both. One you probably know, the other perhaps not. Lauryn Hill, formerly of the Fugees, largely wrote, produced, arranged, and performed her debut solo album, Miss Education of Lauryn Hill. It was released in the summer of 98, recorded in Jamaica. You can hear the influence of the turmoil surrounding the Fugees, her pregnancy, as well as her religious faith. I consider it by far one of the greatest albums of the 90s, and it's even in my top 50 of all time. I listen to it today, it still holds up, sounds relevant, amazing. Doo-wop, that thing, which I will not sing,
was come
a
on.
Big hit. But my favorite track is To Zion, which was a love song to her son. And let's listen to a clip right now.
And I thank you for choosing me to come through unto life to be a beautiful reflection of his grace. See, I know that a gift so great is only one God could create. And I'm reminded every time I see your face that the
joy
of my world is in Zion.
gives me chills every time. This album is available for download on Freegal, and I think we still have a couple copies in circulation of the CD.
I'm going to steal them now.
Right, exactly.
And we don't steal things here.
And now on to the artists you may not have heard of, like Otis Redding. She died way too young. Eva Cassidy.
Songbird.
Absolutely. Tragically short life. She died of melanoma at age 33, I think in late 1996. She remains one of the greatest interpretive singers of all time. She didn't just sing covers. She makes you forget the original recording ever existed. Take her version of Cyndi Lauper's Time After Time.
The drum beats out of time. If you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Time after time. If you fall, I will catch you. I'll be waiting. Time after time.
I sure hope Cyndi Lauper has heard that recording. The library has a couple of posthumously released albums put together from live recordings and studio demos, Time After Time and Imagine. But the one I think you really should hear is a live album, Jesse. It's called Live at Blues Alley. It was recorded in January 1996 in Washington, D.C. And when I hear her sing What a Wonderful World during this concert, I totally think it is. So, Amanda, who's your favorite?
Well, I've been listening to a lot of different music, trying to decide because there's just so many to pick, but I think I've narrowed it finally down to Alec Baldwin.
Back up.
Oh, wait, sorry. That's the wrong, that was last week's. No, I'm going to talk today about Charles Ives, a little bit more classical than what my fellow podcasters have talked about. He was born in Connecticut in the late 1800s to George Ives, who was a U.S. Army band leader, actually, during the Civil War. And when Charles was little, he used to sit in the town square in Danbury, Connecticut, and he would listen, you know, as the marching bands passed by, and he loved the point where he could still hear two bands, but they were playing very dissonant and different things on top of one another, and so that kind of shaped his musical background. His dad was his first music teacher, but he did study at Yale, and for a long time he worked as a church organist, which if you listen to any catalog of his music, you will always hear church hymns, other church tunes, so that also shaped part of his background. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, for him, like most musicians, he decided to take a day job so that he could pay the bills. And for the better part of his life, he worked as an insurance agent. This actually wasn't just a side job for him. He was actually very good at it. And he developed the foundation for the method that we still use today for estate planning. So apparently Mr. Ives was very smart. The biggest thing about his music is he loves the dissonance. As I mentioned, he borrows a lot from familiar hymn tunes, American folk melodies, and then it's this like crunchy juxtaposition of the different tunes on top of each other in different unrelated keys that really gives the work its signature Ivesian dissonance. I was going to play a portion from Variations on America that he wrote. Unfortunately, the library doesn't have a copy of it, so you'll just have to check that out on your own. Instead, I want to talk about his Piano Sonata No. 2, which is also called the Concord Sonata. This monster work that he wrote starting in 1904 and actually finished it in 1920. And it has four movements that each represent a different major figure from the Transcendentalist movement, which is why the work is named after Concord, Massachusetts, which was the center of Transcendentalism. Am I saying that right? Transcendentalism?
I just got transcendentalized.
Okay. Awesome. So the first movement is called Emerson after Ralph Waldo Emerson, and the second movement is named after Nathaniel Hawthorne. The third movement is called Alcott's after Bronson, Alcott and his daughter Louisa May, who you may recognize as the author of Little Women and that whole string of books. And then for the fourth movement is based on Henry David Thoreau. So let's listen to the very beginning of the third movement called the Alcott's. Thank you.
that sound kind of familiar? I thought it did when I listened to it, so I did a little research. Turns out, Bruce Hornsby actually borrowed that exact riff for the beginning of his song, Every Little Kiss, off his 1986 album, The Way It Is. So, just like that. Yes, it was very
pretty.
What
are the odds?
I know. Who knew that Bruce Hornsby liked Charles Ives? So Ives' music actually was not very well known during his lifetime, especially not while he was composing, kind of towards the end of his life. He died in 1954. Kind of the 1940s was when people really started to play his music, especially Bernstein was a big champion of his, playing his Symphony No. 2, I believe. So Charles Ives, very dissonant. Not kind of relaxing music that you think you would like to put on to chill out on a Sunday afternoon, but still very interesting, worthwhile music.
I would chill out to that.
Yeah, but you like noise music, so you're...
Was he overshadowed by Burl Ives? Are they related?
His cousin.
No, I did not look that up, and I would say I would pick Charles Ives over Burl Ives, but that's...
What about his film output? You're not putting that into perspective.
So, Lisa, who are you listening to?
Well, I'm going to tell you about Chet Baker. A documentary called Let's Get Lost played about 2 years ago at the Bell Court, and though I'd seen the name Chet Baker written out on album covers and mentioned in jazz rough guides, that screening served as a gorgeous two-hour crash course on the troubled musician's life and work for me. There's a haunting scene about midway through where a once boyishly handsome, though now quite ravaged Baker sings the Elvis Costello-penned composition Almost Blue. The deeply moving delivery of these lines in a ruined, occasionally off-key, though somewhat confident voice was the hook, line, and sinker it took for me to fall all the way in love with the music of Chet Baker. Though his biography reads like a 50s pulp paperback, complete with heroin addiction, a number of questionable romantic entanglements, and a mysterious death, falling out of a hotel window in Amsterdam in the late 80s, you'd never know it to listen to the breezy, carefree West Coast jazz he recorded in the 50s and 60s. One of his most enduring recordings, 1956's appropriately titled Chet Baker Sings, heralded a significant shift in the way male jazz vocalists approach the microphone, as both song choice and style on that record are as solid and smooth as any to come out of the golden age of mid-century jazz. Following his discography from his early work with fellow jazz great Dave Brubeck, to his solo output, to his later career comeback through his collaborations with Elvis Costello, is a rocky journey with both professional and personal highs and lows. But overall, when you're reaching for a really cool American record on a really hot American summer day, Chet Baker is one name you'd like to see on the cover.
I had a friend who collected the Chet Baker heroin money records, like the Chet Baker sings
just
the songs
ones.
Of the Muppets or whatever, like ridiculous things he would do. I don't think that actually exists, but he would just make ridiculous albums so that he could have money for his
the poor guy.
Horse.
Habit.
Yeah.
I always just think he's really cute on that on his album covers.
Well, it's so funny because I watched it and it reminded me of that movie, Grey Gardens, because throughout Grey Gardens you're going, when Edie Beale's like, I used to be a great beauty, and you're going, yeah, now look at you. And then with Chet Baker, like, you see him singing stuff like Almost Blue in the 80s and you're like, there's no way he used to be good looking or he used to be like a good singer. And you're like, oh my god,
it's kind of dreamy.
Yeah. To come from, to, you know, it's like a Mrs. Haversham kind of thing. It's sort of like American Gothic. Yeah.
He also had a wedding cake rotting on his dining room table
for years.
Like Mrs. Haversham.
Like the Beals in Grey Gardens too.
Man,
there's things around their house rotting.
It's all big circle.
So I was thinking the same lines along as Amanda. I was thinking just real big, I think, or, you know, influential. So I wanted to talk about John Cage, and I was really kind of hoping that you would also talk about Harry Parch, but you can tell everyone what you told me.
I just don't care about it that much. Like, it's interesting, but I didn't care to talk about it.
So as we could get Charles Ives and John Cage and Harry Parch all in, like, the same show, it's like the Three Stooges of American dissonance, right? But nah, it's
a... It'd be the Three Stooges who are jerks and talk about music that people don't listen to.
I listen.
I'm just joking.
I listen to Charles Ives, and I listen to John Cage. I don't know.
Yeah, Harry I don't listen to Harry.
I like the idea of Harry Parch as a hobo building his own instruments.
Exactly.
But other than that, he didn't do anything well with the instruments either. Sorry to interrupt.
Well, that's okay, because you know what? It's kind of right. So I'm totally going to subvert the whole, like, music thing somewhat when I talk about Cage. But, you know, I always talk about, like, noise music or free music or music that's not music, broken music. And I think it's really John Cage is the one established sort of, you know, art establishment composer that really made that acceptable amongst critics or not acceptable or public, you know. Mm-hmm. So he's probably the first composer to really use genuinely non-musical sounds and chants, or at least controlled chants, in his compositions. And of course, if you're using non-musical sounds that are arranged by chance, I mean, maybe it's not something that you're going to put on a Sunday afternoon to listen to. And I think mostly those are really about the performance. It's about being there in the moment, you know, absolutely. It's about, you know, it's like a performance art piece. So it's, your recordings of them are kind of absurd. But I guess I just like to point out that if you go there with him and his ideas and that's okay with you, you probably do like noise music or free jazz or, you know, improv, that kind of thing, or electroacoustic improv to get even more inanely subgenre-esque. But I just like to say, too, that even though people who are okay with John Cage's ideas like that kind of music, he himself, I don't think, is really okay with all those kind of genres I just mentioned. He was a very anal composer. Mm-hmm. Like, his oeuvre is long and diverse, and it changed throughout his career. Like, he was a totally exacting, anal retentive, throw a hammer out at you if you don't play it right composer, conductor. So I just don't think that the stereotypes that people have about his music really reflects the way that he really was. But if a recording of his work isn't something that you really want to hear, you could read his book, The Silence, which kind of lays out his theories. And the book itself, The Silence, is itself a work of art. Like, the typography is amazing. Like, when he wrote essays and poetry, you know, they were never just normal on the page. Like, you know, all the shape of the text and the font and everything is a total work of art. You could read that book like it was poetry and philosophy and not have to sit through an opera singer singing an aria in 5 different languages with 10 people dialing random things on transistor radios, right? So, but you could, you know, the book, I think, is very enlightening. And I thought, too, about, like, well, why is, outside of some really avant-garde works where, like, maybe someone stood at the piano doesn't say anything, like, why is he so intriguing? And I think, like a lot of the people that we've talked about, maybe with the exception of Charles Ives, he just has such an amazingly charismatic personality. And, like, if you go to archive.org and just do a search for John Cage, you can hear these radio broadcasts that he did where he's interviewed. And he speaks like a guru. He speaks like a Zen guru, or the way that when the Dalai Lama talks, or the way they're different. Like, I don't know who the spiritual leaders are today. Probably John Cage or Otis Redding, right? But you know, what, it's just like when he speaks, you can tell it's like, it's not just because he's a Buddhist. Because I'm sure there are millions of Buddhists in the world and most of them are boring, right? He's like, his mind is really in a different place. I think that creates a personality cult around him, but definitely an influential artist.
But is he a cult of personality? Yeah.
He was on some episode of a game show in the 50s, one where the people were, like, blindfolded and asked questions to guess your profession. And he was What's my line? Yeah, he was really charming on that.
I just think that's what's interesting, too. Like, if you ever read stories about the ensembles who came to hate him when they would record his pieces, or places where he would walk out because they didn't record his, you know, perform his pieces correctly the way he wanted. You know, his personality just seems so overwhelmed with joy and charisma and just,
well, and I think, too, he's kind of gotten pigeonholed into that guy that wrote the song about nothing. But, I mean, he wrote a lot of stuff for, like, prepared piano. I mean, he created that where you put, like, screws and stuff inside the piano to make it sound, like, not like a piano, like other stuff. And I've got a really cool recording. I don't know if we have it here. It's got that, and it's got, like, he used a toy piano, and, like, he composed for, like, an 8-note little tinny toy piano. And because he actually did a lot of rhythmic stuff for, you know, with his partner, Merce Cunningham, who was a ballet dancer. Like, he did a lot of work with him. And so, I mean, he still did stuff that you can consider, you know, finger quotes music, not just the really out there stuff. So it just kind of depends on what he was writing for at the time.
Totally. I think he's, like, early, the percussion pieces just sounds like American minimalism that was sort of happening at the time. Yeah. It's not outside of that box at all.
I always get him confused with John Cale, the guy, the violist from the Velvet Underground. Sorry.
Or J.J. Cale, whoever that guy is.
That guy.
You're just making up people now.
It's a real person.
Paul McCartney Cale.
Johnny Cage, the video game fighter from Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, the movie star.
Now we're going to find out what is tickling our fancy, you know, the things that are making us, our brains buzz, at least those of us who have something that is buzzing our brains, besides cicadas and 90-degree heat.
Crystal here. The past month, I've been really obsessed with mountaineering. The window of opportunity to make it to the summit of Mount Everest just closed, and so I've been following that closely. And we've got a lot of really cool books if you're interested, like I am, and a NOVA documentary that came out in 98 called Everest, The Death Zone, and they studied some mountaineers and tested them and their brain capacity at various levels up the mountain. So if you're interested like I am, you should check it out. How about you, Amanda? What's tickling you today, this week?
Well, I am not a big fan of reality TV, except once in a while I'll find one that just rocks my world. So last Friday, I was sick, and I happened to turn the TV on, and I was flipping through onto the History Channel, and my beloved Ice Road Truckers have come back to me. I spent the whole day, I started at 10 o'clock in the morning until I had to go to a concert that night at like 7, watching Ice Road Truckers. And the kicker was the new season started this last Sunday. So if you're into Ice Road Trucking, they're driving on the Dalton in Alaska. In the snow, and the ice, I don't know how they do it. But if you find that interesting, History Channel, Sunday night, 8 o'clock. Two of the drivers have actually written books that I have checked out right now. Hugh has a book that the library has, I think it's called On Thin Ice. And then Alex has a book called, I think it's called King of the Road, that we don't have, but the Interlibrary Loan Office would be happy to get that for you if you're interested. So that's Ice Road Truckers, Sunday night, 8 p.m., History Channel.
Can you drive a truck to Mount Everest?
Can Alec Baldwin drive
a truck? You know what? They did. Ice Road Truckers had the deadliest roads that they did last summer, that they were driving trucks in the Himalayas. So I don't know if you can go up to the top of Everest, but they were, I mean, these roads were insane.
I imagine you couldn't go up to Everest.
I've never done it. I should ask Crystal. She's a mountaineer.
The answer would be no.
But I mean, they were up. I mean, they were like 10,000 feet up, and they were like on this little tiny ledge and. It made me nervous, but not
as fun. You can actually drive a truck to the top of Everest, and there's a shopping mall there.
Really?
Does the sit go?
Does it have a gap?
You could get
there's
Slim Jims.
McDonald's.
I don't think a gap.
If you hit a Yeti, it's 100 points.
Yeah.
That's that game Made Egg Mountain. That's not.
So, Lisa, what you got?
I don't have anything to do with ice or truckers or Everest, but I was reading a book called Alligators, Old Mink, and New Money by Allison Hoot, H-O-U-T-T-E. And it's a book about a woman who modeled in the late 80s and opened a vintage clothing store in New York City. And so I was interested in it. I'm trying to get over my grief for them closing Flashback out on Elliston Place. So this is getting me through it.
Okay, so what's tickling my fancy this week is actually an internet show called TechSnap. I know that's exciting. Of all the geeky things I've ever talked about, this is probably the geekiest, but I'm just totally hooked on the show. It's an internet show on this website called Jupiter Broadcasting, which is actually an internet network that this guy created in his house, and it's actually very high quality, and it's amazing. But so TechSnap, these two geeks, they just talk about tech issues, and especially with, like, security. But because they've been all these hacks in the news region, like the Sony hacks and the Gmail hack and the PBS hack and the Lockheed Martin hack and the company that also was, like, had this contract with the FBI, they've had a lot to talk about. And so all these hacks, they actually talk about how they actually happened. Like, how could you actually hack Lockheed Martin? How would that work? And they do it in a way that's non-techy enough that you can just listen and understand what they're talking about. Like, you don't have to be a computer programmer and know what they're talking about. I just think it's really interesting because you read other news stories and it's just like, you know, Sony hacked. And it doesn't say why. Like, it's this real magical thing. But these guys, Alan and Chris, actually talk about what they actually did or what the steps are of how they do that. And in most cases, all of these companies, right, just end up basically, you're stupid. Like, you're an electronics company. You're an internet company, right? You are a defense contractor, right? That was the one that's actually probably the least liable. Like, with Gmail and everything, like, they were just fished, you know, and people gave up their passwords. Like, in Sony, people just gave up their passwords. But I don't want to spill the beans. You can watch TechSnap. So you can go to JupiterBroadcasting.com, and you can scroll through all their shows. But I guess, too, I just wanted to throw out some love to Chris Fisher, the guy who created Jupiter Broadcasting, because he actually just made his own TV network about things that he likes. I suppose this is how this kind of relates to pop culture. More so, it's like him and his friends play Star Trek Online. So they created a TV show about Star Trek Online. And it's awesome. They interview the developers on Star Trek Online all the time. Well, I suppose it would be if you're into Star Trek Online. I don't know, Star Trek Online. But they also do the Linux Action Show, which is like, if anyone's into the Linux world knows, that's like the TV show about Linux. And he just like created it himself. kudos to him for actually doing that and, like, creating his own TV network about things that he likes. And the shows are awesome. They're super high quality. They're really informed. They're edited well. And, like, he doesn't have a studio. It's in his garage, but you would never know. It's really cool. And they're on YouTube, too, if you didn't want to go to his website. So TechSnap, check it out. I'll put a link in the show notes.
I think that show is smarter than I am.
Public Library's Pop-Matic podcast. For more information, please visit www.library.nashville.org.
That's on the interwebs.
Finish him.